second part of the interview with Richard M. Helms took place on July 24th, 1985.
Testing 1, 2, 3. When you talked to the Shah, did you get the impression that he feared the Soviet Union, or was he more concerned about the political strength of revolutionary nationalist movements in the region, various nationalist forces? Was he concerned about those, or the Russians more?
I never got the sense that the Shah was frightened by the Russians. Mm-hmm. After all, Russia and Persia have been neighbors for these thousands of years, and I truly think that the Shah believed his policy vis-a-vis Russia was one that was designed to keep the peace between the two countries. So that in point of fact, if he had any concerns about who might take him on in war or fight with him, if you like, I think he felt the most likely candidate would be Iraq, even though he had made genuine efforts to keep the peace with Iraq. As I indicated earlier, the Shah's theme in this period was to have stability in the area, and he worked very hard at this and very pragmatically at it, and he intended to keep stability as best he could with all his neighbors.
So he didn't see the Soviet Union as a basic threat in any immediate terms.
Uh-huh. And he was realistic about it. He said, you know, my intention is that if the Soviets were to attack Iran, I have every intention of pursuing a scorched earth policy. Now, whether he would have been successful in getting his people to go along with the scorched earth policy, I don't know. But that was his intention, because having been invaded by the Russians twice, not only in World War II, but also years earlier, he had no intention of turning his country over to the Soviet Union.
Did his assessment more or less correspond with those American officials who looked at these things in terms of his assessment of the Soviet Union as a not really a major threat?
Well, I don't know what Americans really thought about it. And I don't think they thought it was very realistic that he should follow a scorched earth policy. And they didn't think he'd have a chance of fighting the Soviet Union if their troops actually invaded the country. And a lot of people just laughed at him, the United States government. On the other hand, United States officials aren't always right about these things, and I'm inclined to think that if the Russians had attacked, the Iranians might very well have made at least an effort to defend themselves. At least I think they were going to destroy everything in the Russians' path if they could arrange to do so. At least that was the Shah's policy.
But I think in terms of the immediate, the contemporary period, the immediate future, as people looked at it back in the early 70s, was the major concern seemed to be more like regional problems as opposed to any great power conflict in the region.
How do you separate
those things out?
I think so.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's been a great debate going on in American governmental and academic circles over the whole issue of whether the Shah should have tried to rearm himself, whether he should have bought sophisticated and expensive equipment from the United States. I've been reading recently Gary Sick's book entitled All Fall Down, and the debates are set forth in that book, and I think reasonably accurately. The only thing that the Sick book overlooks, and maybe it's because it did not deal with this particular period, but when the Iraqis finally did attack Iran 5 years ago, if it had not been for the weapons that the Shah had bought during the period that he was in power, and for the stockpiles of spare parts that he had hidden around in various parts of his country, the Iranians probably would have been overwhelmed.
And in terms of the Shah's interest in playing a major role in his region as a sort of guarantor of stability, Did he require much U.S. encouragement, or was encouragement really unnecessary?
Well, I don't know what he required, but he got it in 1972 from President Nixon, and I think that is clear.
Yeah.
And President Nixon wanted him to try and be the strong and stable power in the Persian Gulf area, because when the British had moved out under that rubric of we're going to reduce their influence, quote, east of Suez, unquote, and pulled out of the Trucial States, it obviously created a vacuum in the Persian Gulf area.
Okay. Now, in 1973, the Shah took sides in a civil war in Dhofar province in Oman. It might have been early in 73, but at least 73 was one phase of that activity.
That is correct.
Can you discuss those moves with you?
Can
you discuss his moves with you in that situation? Did he discuss this with you at all?
No, in the sense that he did not discuss the moves before he made them.
Mm-hmm.
But when I saw him and inquired from time to time about how the war in Dhofar was going, he would generally inform me as to what the Iranians were doing, his effort to support Sultan Qaboos in his fight with these rebels, and also, quite aside from that, he felt this was excellent training for his forces, particularly the Air Force, and pursued this assistance to Qaboos with genuine, what's the word I'm looking for? For a real assertiveness. I mean, he wanted to help. He also saw a utility in trying to help in terms of the training of his own people, and therefore he kept right after it. He had a reasonably close relationship with Sultan Qaboos. In fact, I think he tended to regard him sort of as a, quote, son, unquote. And as a result of this, he saw no conflict in his own mind with supporting him, and seeing to it that these rebels did not either divide up his country, take part of it away, or cause him to be defeated, if you like.
And the U.S. given any support or any aid in this effort? Was there any?
Not of which I'm aware.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. And I don't think so. I don't think he needed it. I think he had what he wanted, and he used his own equipment and his own people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Apparently, the Shah also gave military support to the right-wing militia in Lebanon during the mid-70s.
In Lebanon? What was that supposed to be? Who are these right-wing?
Well, the people, the Marani militia in Lebanon.
I think the Shah was sympathetic to the Maronite Christians, but I don't recall, aside maybe from some money, that he gave any tangible support to the Mariners.
He didn't discuss it with you at all.
Well, I used to talk with him about business that he would have from Lebanese leaders.
Yeah.
But it does not stick in my mind any element that he may have given some money.
Yeah.
I don't remember all that accurately. But I recall no arms and nothing like that.
Okay. When you were ambassador, was there any special effort to foster Iran-Saudi Arabian relations under the Twin Pillars doctrine? And how was that policy pursued by the U.S.?
Well, the U.S. really didn't have much influence on Iranian-Saudi relationships, because it was agreed, I think, by the Shah as well as by King Faisal, that these two countries were friends of the United States, and that they should not be at the daggers drawn. The only unfortunate part about the whole thing was that when the Shah and Faisal met on at least one occasion, they simply talked past each other. That King Faisal was always talking about the great Zionist conspiracy, and would talk endlessly about this. The Shah would get bored with hearing him. King Faisal didn't want to bother to hear what the Shah had to say. And then underlying the whole thing was the basic suspicion that Arabs have about Persians and that Persians have about Arabs.
Mm-hmm.
And this had not been helped by the controversy over the status of Bahrain in earlier years, or the disposition of the Toombs Islands in the Persian Gulf. So there was always a latent suspicion between these two countries and these two powers, even though they actually had no antipathy the one toward the other in terms of any warlike attitudes. They were always together in OPEC, talking about oil prices and trying to work on the whole problem of oil. So they didn't collaborate much, but also they didn't quarrel with each other much either.
Was there any U.S. effort to sort of mitigate the suspicion or encourage collaboration?
Well, I think the United States made some small efforts, but they weren't very effective.
Mm-hmm. I read that in the 1975 Sinai disengagement treaty, there was a clause that Iran would guarantee Israel's oil supplies in a crisis.
Yes.
And does it take place in any aspect of that discussion, any phase of the negotiations concerning Iran's role?
Well, Iran had a very straightforward policy, which had been consistent.
Mm-hmm.
The Shah's policy was that he sold oil to anybody who was prepared to buy it. And he continued with this policy right through the 1973 war, so that when this issue came up of would you guarantee oil for the Israelis, the Shah's reply, as I recall, was if the Israelis pay for their own, they can have it. So this was not one of the, if that was a part of the agreement, I do not recall any detailed work to put it in there. I think it was just part and parcel of what the United States knew Iran's policy is.
That's very straightforward.
Yeah.
Now, I have a few supplementary questions to the last meeting. Now, at one point you said, in response to one of my questions, you said that except for a few key individuals, like Amir Asadullah Alam, that most of the Shah's cabinet did not speak frankly with the Shah on most occasions. You had that impression.
Well, when I say speak frankly, I think they spoke frankly.
Yeah.
But what I meant to convey was that they were not about to argue with the Shah, and they did not like to bring him bad news.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think that was the case? What was the problem?
I think they were generally concerned that if they argued with him, he would find somebody else to do that job.
In terms of bad news.
In terms of bad news, I'm referring to the fact that I don't believe that he was adequately and accurately informed about what was going on in his own country by the head of SAVAK or by his other ministers in those latter days after Alam became so sick that he couldn't be helpful and finally died. And Alam and Iqbal, as I pointed out there, were the two that kept their ear to the ground, had resources to find out what was going on in the country independent of SAVAK, and who might have alerted him to the fact that the situation was more serious than apparently he believed.
Okay. Now, according to some analysts of the revolution, the Shah fell because he had character deficiencies, psychological inability to compromise, personal insecurity, indecisiveness, and so forth. From what you saw of the man and the new ambassador, does any of that ring true?
It may be that there are elements of all of those things, and it may be that none of them really were definitive in the end. It is so easy for academicians to sit in a room and take up reasons why certain things have happened in terms of personality failings and so on. And I think in the Shah's case, this is a difficult thing to be definitive about. There isn't any question that when he took over in his early 20s from his father in World War II, that he certainly was an indecisive young man, overwhelmed in a sense by his responsibilities, but he had a very difficult road to hoe, if you like that American expression, that it took him some years to develop, to grow in his responsibilities, to become the Shah in the way that He thought the Shah ought to conduct his business. The fact that he was indecisive, in, as some people say, in the latter months of his reign, and i.e. in 1978, can well be answered by the fact that he was confronted by a series of problems that would have made almost anybody indecisive, particularly if you believed, as he did, that he should not slaughter his people in the streets. And in saying this, I'm not defending the Shah, I'm attempting to clarify, because recently I wrote a letter to Sir Anthony Parsons, who was the British ambassador in Iran at that time, and he wrote back saying that he had not noticed in 78, until the very end, very much indecisiveness on the Shah's part, and that at the end he was confronted with so many difficulties that there was really very little he could do about it. Now, what story is right and what is wrong, I don't know. It can certainly be said that the Shah believed in his rule, that he wanted to keep all the details of the country's doings in his hands. He even promoted all the officers in the Army, Navy, and Air Force. In short, he was in that sense a rigid ruler. When it came to flexibility, I'm not sure what they mean when they talk about flexibility. The flexibility we did show in sort of letting up in terms of repression and civil rights and so forth, some students of the scene have said that he never should have done this, but that was what let the cork out of the bottle, and from there on he lost control of the situation. And I'm sure that for a long time historians will differ as to exactly what the Shah's problem was in 1978 in dealing with this ongoing situation. And the books are already starting to appear, taking sides one way or the other. And I don't think that I can contribute any, dooming insights into exactly what did go astray. In any event, I want to give you, to make a part of this interview, an article which I was asked to write. I think it was in the summer of 1979. In other words, it was after the Shah had left Tehran, or left his country, and it was an article written for the Institute for the Study of Diplomacy at Georgetown University. And the article was in a little booklet which contained a symposium on, quote, contacts with the opposition, unquote. I give this to you because I think that it gives the views that I held at a time much closer to the time of the Shah's fall in 1985, and it might be of some marginal interest in the context of this interview.
Okay, thank you. In one of the same lines, some analysts have suggested that the Shah's personal affinity with Nixon and Kissinger had something to do with the strengthening of the U.S.-Iranian relations during the 1970s. I think that was an important factor at all to be considered in terms of comparison with strategic and economic considerations.
I rather thought that Nixon, who had known the Shah for many years from the time that he was vice president of the United States, believed that he was handling the affairs of his country with some skill. There was no one else to turn to in the Persian Gulf era. After all, Iran has the largest population in that area. It's got a border that stretches for miles along the Persian Gulf. It has controls one side of the Strait of Hormuz, through which all the oil tankers have to pass, entering and leaving the Persian Gulf. In short, he was a likely fellow for them to identify as the one that could be helpful under the terms of the so-called Nixon Doctrine of maintaining some stability and some pro-American intercourse in that area.
In terms of the, I guess the argument was that Shah had sort of like a personal affinity with Nixon and Kissinger themselves, and that led us for him to identify more closely with the U.S.-Iran relationship.
It was very difficult.
Is that something you could...
to identify affinities, so-called, between chiefs of state and chiefs of government. This is one of these myths that grows in the minds of students, I think, largely, because they believe that the personal relationship is really, in the end, the only thing that counts. And I can promise you that in the case of Richard Nixon, even in the United States of America, he had no close friends or associates. And the Shah had no close friends or associates. That kind of person doesn't go in for that. And therefore, they were certainly not bosom buddies. They simply saw an identity of interest. They were both good geopoliticians. They were pragmatic, and they made an arrangement between them.
Yeah, that was a point made by one of them. I think John Stemple made that point in his book at some point. I thought you might want to...
That's all right. Yeah, John Stemple is a very bright and able Foreign Service officer, but that doesn't mean he's right.
Okay. Can I ask some questions about how the embassy worked and your role in the embassy during the 70s? When you were ambassador, what tasks took up most of your time on a sort of day-to-day basis? What kind of things did you... work on the most, or the things took up most of your time?
Well, I did my ambassadorial chores in terms of representing the country at various governmental functions and national functions. I was the one who talked to the Shah, which I did with regularity. I was the one who talked to the Minister of Court Alam, which I did with regularity. I was the one who talked to the Prime Minister, and usually to other ministers if that was necessary. I did some traveling in the country. I was obviously not in day-to-day charge of the workings of the embassy, since I left that to the DCM, which is the proper way to handle these matters in modern-day embassies. But I did stay in touch and talk with most of the counselors. I had daily staff meetings, which I guided the work of the embassy and so forth. I handled the CODELs, and all those congressional delegations, when they came to Iran. In short, I think I did what ambassadors normally would have done. I was a bit handicapped by the fact that I was constantly being called back to Washington, first for the Watergate hearings, and then later for hearings in connection with the investigations of the Central Intelligence Agency in 1975. But despite, I think, 16 round trips between Washington and Tehran, or the United States and Iran, in my term of office, which lasted for 3 3/4 years, I still was able to stay on top of the job all right.
Who are your key advisors at the embassy? Who did you rely most upon for, say, advice about political economic matters that came up?
Well, I had good DCNs. The first one was Douglas Heck. The second one was Jack Nicklaus, MIKLLS. And both of those were thoroughly experienced Foreign Service officers. They had either worked on Iran or had been in Iran for some time, and they were quite competent to advise with me. I had a good economic counselor in William Layfelt. I had 2 or 3 political counselors, but I was inclined to be my own political counselor. And I had the station chiefs were fairly competent individuals. So I had a good staff at the embassy. I was well treated in terms of the personnel assigned to Tehran.
Mm-hmm. Was anybody that was particularly influential in your thinking about Iran? Any one person that had some bigger influence on your thinking about the country and the situation there?
Well, I don't think there was any particular person. I got to know Iranians and began to talk to them and began to learn from them. Mm-hmm. I obviously learned from them in the embassy. This was a learning process, no doubt about it. But I can't point any single individual who had more influence than another.
Was there much supervision from Washington? Did you work under any particular constraints as ambassador? Or did you have a fairly free hand in what you did and said?
Yes, I did, because when I accepted the appointment to Iran, it was actually offered to me by the president himself, which is not usual. And I had known the president of my service as director of Central Intelligence. I knew the Secretary of State because I'd known him when he was Attorney General, and I'd known him around Washington in between. I knew the National Security Advisor Kissinger. Henry Kissinger, who later became Secretary of State, and I'd worked with him a great deal during the Nixon period. So I knew all the key players. And I did not feel under any particular constraints. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, when I went out, I was told orally by President Nixon that he wanted me also to keep an eye on the whole Persian Gulf area. But at that time, there was only one ambassador accredited to Kuwait, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, and so forth. And they had consuls in those countries as residents. And this ambassador would travel from Kuwait through the area. Mm-hmm. And the president wanted regular reports about what I thought about the political and military situation throughout the Gulf. I subsequently, at least during my time there, recommended to him that he send ambassadors to each of those countries, because I felt that there was, with the rise in the oil prices, the growing influence of that part of the world, the pride and dignity of these individual countries and their leaders, that it would be desirable to have an ambassador in each country that would make our relations with the countries more effective, mm-hmm. and also more friendly. Mm-hmm. And this recommendation was adopted.
Okay. Did you have any important disagreements with Washington over any policy matters, or was there pretty much a consensus of policy throughout the years?
Well, I think that there may have been one or two occasions on which I may have disagreed with an instruction I was given, in which event I simply replied and told him the reasons for disagreeing. But the policy of the United States toward Iran, I was in sympathy with, and I didn't have any difficulty carrying it out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In terms of the Washington officials who were concerned with Iran, is there any key official in the State Department or elsewhere who had a major hand in working out policy towards Iran? Like people like Cisco, is he very important, or of particular importance, or who did he hire?
I think that Kissinger felt that he knew what the policy the United States toward Iran was from his time visit there with President Nixon in 1972. Mm-hmm. And he had been obviously working on Iran as he had with other parts of the world. But the State Department was obviously had its ideas and gave me guidance and so forth, and the country director at the time, most of the time that I was in Iran, was Charles Naz, N-A-A-S, who had served in Kabul and had been in that part of the world and had been working away for some time on these matters. He was highly competent and very helpful, good backstopper.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And before him it had been Miklos, who later came to replace Heck, as I told you earlier, and Miklos was thoroughly conversant with the policy on Iran and what had happened there. And so.
Okay. Here's a question about the arms sales issues when you were ambassador. When you were ambassador, how heavy was your involvement in arms sales issues? Was it something that took a lot of time over the years?
Well, it was a question that was invariably on my desk because as a result of the promise of President Nixon to have the Shah buy what military equipment he wanted for the United States, and then the subsequent rise in oil prices in 73, giving the Shah the money to buy the equipment he wanted, this obviously became a big business. And every arms merchant in the United States came to Tehran.
You were talking about the visits by arms salesmen to Iran.
Yes, and so obviously I was involved in this. And then Secretary Schlesinger, Secretary of Defense, sent over Richard Halleck and later sent over Eric von Marbod, that's B-O-N, capital M-A-R-B-O-D. I dealt with these men and I dealt with Schlesinger, and we were all doing our best to make sense out of this arms sales business, trying to see to it the Shah was well served in that he was advised about what the United States has, what this equipment would do for him, what he should purchase and so forth. And I realized that the belief exists that the Shah sort of had an open-ended arrangement with the United States on these arms sales. This was never the case, as nearly as I saw. All of these things were discussed at great length with him. And the issue of whether he needed as much as he bought is a question that may never be resolved, except in the fashion that I mentioned earlier in this interview, and that is that when the Iraqis attacked 5 years ago, Iran was unable to defend itself very well, and the Iraqis took over Khorramshahr and half of Abadan, and then finally were stopped by the Iranians, and then over time were chased out by the Iranian army. And without those arms, the Iranians never would have been able to do this. But it could be said that the Khomeini government in Iran, that's too bad that they had arms at all. But I don't take that position. I don't like the Khomeini government. But I'm not about to say that the Iranians need to be give up ground to the Iraqis or vice versa in the context of what would you say, Middle Eastern geopolitics. I mean, I don't take that position. So in any event, all those people who were so wise that they knew exactly what the Shah needed in the United States, all those people in the United States government who were so wise that they knew exactly what the Shah needed, I'm not sure in the end they were actually correct. But in any event, a major effort was made to police this, to handle it with some good sense, at times to put the brakes on, in other words, to do the best we could.
So how would you characterize the decision-making process in the executive branch, maybe the embassy, when it came to making decisions on particular weapons systems? What kind of review process?
There was an entire military staff called Armish Mag, headed by a major general. There was a general. I've forgotten the names of the. There were two or three during my time. Yeah. I think it was a General Twitchell and. And there was a General Vandenberg of the Air Force who was there for a short time. And he was succeeded by another general of the Air Force whose name eludes me. Did you look that up?
Yeah.
There was a major American advisory mission there to deal with these matters.
In terms of the executive branch back in Washington, there was like a... It's been charged. I guess it's the Senate Committee Report of 76, the major report the Oil Relations Committee put out. They suggested that the on sales decisions were exempted from the ordinary review channels in Defense Department and State Department. The military on sales bureaucracies in the
Was this the Inspector General's report of the State Department?
Relations Committee.
Correct?
The staff of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee made a report in 76 on arms sales to Iran. And they suggested so that the State Department's and Defense Department's review channels for arms sales decisions was taken out of the process or something.
Well, I don't remember the details of that anymore.
Yeah.
And there are other documents and other individuals know a lot more about this than I do. I wouldn't want to debate that with you because I don't know what the regular review channels were at the time.
Yeah. So it was mostly the mission, the embassy staff that looked at these decisions and not so much people in Washington or...
Well, I think people in Washington looked at them too.
Yeah.
And certainly this Irish Mag group looked at them.
Mm-hmm.
And the Irish Mag had many more people in the embassy. It was a big outfit.
Yeah. Okay. Now after stuff late 73 when Iran's, when the oil prices went up at great levels, was there any, was there a great increase in Iran's national income as a result of the OPEC price increases? Was there any effort to review or reconsider our sales policy as our purchasing power went up? Or was its policy more or less continued as it...
The policy was continued pretty well throughout. I won't say that it wasn't reviewed from time to time, because it was, but one had a situation here in which it seemed desirable from a policy standpoint to have a strong an Iran that was strong militarily. The Shah was able to purchase the weapons. The purchase of the weapons was useful to the United States government because it made money. This was one way of recycling the so-called petrodollars that were being dispensed in order to buy oil. So it was regarded as a reasonably satisfactory economic arrangement for the United States.
Mm-hmm. So that sort of strategic aspect in terms of the Shah's role in the area, plus with the commercial considerations,
right.
Reinforcing those.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Was there any concern about the impact that the massive weapons purchases had on Iranian military infrastructure and economic infrastructure, that they might overload that?
Well, there was always this question, because it was quite clear to the embassy, it was clear to Irmish Mag, that the great shortage that Iran was going to have was men who were trained to handle sophisticated weapons, sophisticated aircraft, ships, tanks, and so forth. So there was a vast training program going on to try and not only train people to do ordinary military duties, but also to train officers to handle sophisticated equipment. And this was where, obviously, there was a crunch, because of the way the Shah was buying the equipment. It was a question of whether the manpower could be supplied to man the equipment in adequate numbers.
Now, in the mid-70s, you were quoted as saying the problems that this was causing, the problems that this was causing were so difficult to manage that you sort of washed your hands of certain phases of this question. This is a quote I read in that secondary work.
You know what?
Saying that you had almost washed your hands of the whole business of arms sales because it's so difficult to manage, oversight was so difficult.
I'm sorry, but where was I alleged?
This is my secondary work on. This quote for like the Guardian, Manchester Guardian, I think. That's the... There's some kind of quote of you to that effect. That
well, I don't recall ever having made a comment
that.
I didn't have any sensation that I washed my hands of arms sales.
Mm-hmm.
I obviously was not in a position to make a judgment about every single purchase,
mm-hmm.
but I did have the feeling that there was an organization in being and in position
mm-hmm.
to do this job adequately,
mm-hmm.
and I don't recall ever having made that statement.
Yeah. Okay. I guess one implication of the expansion of the Iranian military system was a growing presence of U.S. nationals in Iran, technicians, experts, military, contract people, and so forth. Was there any concern that this presence might cause problems, sort of like a nationalist reaction in Iran?
Well, there was concern. There was concern on my part.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that the American presence was getting too large. It was 30,000. I think at one time it got as high as 40,000 all through Iran.
Mm-hmm.
I thought this was wrong and unnecessary. I attempted to take some actions to alleviate it. I did away with the mission to the gendarmerie, which had been in existence for some years. I did away with the Peace Corps. I attempted to head off desires on the part of various parts of the our military establishment to set up more bases and more units in Iran. As things were closed down in Turkey, there was great pressure to use Iran as a physical location for various kinds of equipment. And during those, particularly the latter 2 years I was there, I fought off all of these. I thought it was a great mistake to put any more assets,
mm-hmm.
military or otherwise, into that country. There was too much there already, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In terms of the, apparently there was very high pressure sales tactics used by arms sales in the U.S. and so forth, and was in charge of the bribery of Iranian officials and so forth for this period. Did these cause diplomatic problems for you, or was there?
Well, I mean, you never like those incidents because they do cause difficulties and diplomatic problems. Mm-hmm. But none of them turned out to be inside of it. And it never turned out to be to make the arrangements. I mean, none of them worked in such a way that we couldn't continue to do business with the Iranians on a daily basis.
Did the Iranians, did the embassy try to, like, play a role in trying to clean up these things, or was there efforts made or actions taken by the embassy staff to supervise these things? Or
well, I don't think the embassy knew very much about these alleged bribery efforts. There was one episode that became quite notorious involving some brothers called Lavi, L-A-V-I, and this had to do with the sale of the gun in F-14. That's one I remember. If there were others, they don't leap to mind. But the Iranians were trying to deal with this, Americans were trying to deal with it, but that is not an easy subject because it is obviously not, it's done surreptitiously, it's done clandestinely, and unless somebody blows the whistle, it doesn't come to light.
Right, right. Apparently, I read that Secretary Schlesinger briefed the Shah at one point or the other on the implications of buying sophisticated military hardware. Do you recall any kind of briefings of that sort?
We briefed the Shah.
Yeah.
I doubt it was in the terms that you described. I think that he certainly had discussions with the Shah.
Mm-hmm.
And I have no doubt that he pointed out some of the problems inherent in buying certain types of equipment, military supplies from the United States. But when you put it in the phrase, the way you phrased it there, I doubt very much if he would have looked the Shah in the eye and said anything like that to
him. But what was his purpose? You think Schlesinger's purpose in trying to get them to rationalize their purchase systems at some point?
I think he was trying to slow down the orders that the Shah was making. He was trying to make this into an orderly procedure. I think he saw that if we weren't careful, we'd be loading equipment over there that couldn't be used, couldn't be taken from the docks, couldn't be absorbed, and he was anxious to do this in a an orderly fashion, I think that's the best term.
I probably run, I think I've kind of said it before.
Why don't you talk to Schlesinger?